Do it again.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world.
You're listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.
Hey girl, a martini, shaken, not stirred.
Don't try and church it up, son.
You can't handle the truth.
I am big. The picture that got small.
Your first one's on us.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling. I'm your host, Mark Rigadonna. And with me, as always,
Richie Burton,
your producer, Soul Joel.
Well, today we have a special guest in studio with us. We have a very good friend of mine, and we have a fun history because we're new friends. Ladies and gentlemen, Rhonda Handsome's here.
Ooh, one funny Negro, yes.
And that's what she sounds like.
All right, now that she stole my album title.
So now, Rhonda, you and I know each other from John Fugelsang's show.
Oh, yes, yes.
That was how we first met.
Love that.
Now, you're on...
Every Monday.
Every Monday.
2 to 5 p.m.
Anybody listening that has SiriusXM, when you're done listening to us...
Tune in.
Go to Tell Me Everything with John Fugelsang on Mondays, and you get to hear this beautiful voice.
It's Tall, Dark, and Handsome Monday.
And now you guys just recently worked together, right?
Oh, yes. We did a charity event technically, but I've been doing it for years. Comedy Cures, Saren Rothberg. And have I talked about this?
Yes.
I have on the show. Yep. She buses in people who are sick, pretty serious, and their caregivers at Broadway Comedy Club, and they get lunch, and they get a
great comedy show, wonderful sandwiches and sides, and it's not only a boost for them. I mean, the whole thing is so upbeat. It's just like
it makes you feel good.
I love it.
Paul Stanley says. People say give till it hurts. I say give till it feels good.
Yeah. So we worked together on that.
We did that. We had a lot of fun.
I've been doing that for a couple of years.
Yeah, and I've been doing them for 15 years.
And the founder is such a great person who has recovered.
Yes.
She has recovered, and her hair has grown out. She looks fabulous, and she's giving back to others, which is just great.
She and I had a radio show here in New York for a while. That was a Comedy Cures radio show. It was a lot of fun.
I really like her.
She's a good friend, yeah.
Nice. So how we start every show is we start with...
A drink?
With a drink.
Oh.
And so if you're going to drink anything in the world, as Mike Somerville brought it up as, you can drink anything you want. What is your go-to drink?
Ice cold martini.
You like a martini? Now we're talking.
She has come out firing on all cylinders.
Oh, my God. It has to be vodka.
There you go. Yes. Now, how do you like your martinis?
Ice cold straight up. A drop of olive or two in there, and I'm in heaven.
Okay.
Now, it's funny. I love a nice martini, and I can really enjoy two. After that, I am done.
One is good for me.
Yeah.
One is good. Two is great. Anymore, I'm in trouble. Man.
I went to the Brooklyn Academy of Music to hear Jean Baptiste, actually. Okay. And a friend of mine came in and she saw me. She says, "What are you drinking?" I said, "A martini." And she brought me another one and I drank it. When I woke up the next day, I couldn't hear.
Yeah.
So one is good for me as long as it's made well.
I used to work on 95th Street. At a restaurant during the day, and I was dating a girl who lived in that area. And there's a dive bar up the street from the restaurant I worked at that's named the Dive Bar.
I know exactly where that is.
The Dive Bar on 95th in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
And I went there one day after work. It was like 4 or 5 o'clock. And the owner made me an ice-cold martini.
Oh, my God.
I was knocking on that girl's door asking her to marry me.
Well, see, that's the thing about martinis. If they are made well and ice cold, you don't even feel them.
Right.
And that's what was the very interesting thing to me, because I used to see all these movies where these sophisticated people were having cocktails and they would have a martini, or a 007 would, shaken, not stirred.
Which I heard is not the way to order a martini if you actually know anything about martinis.
No, you do not shake a martini.
But I thought it was just so fabulous. And and so worldly. And the first couple of ones I had were horrible. I felt like I was just drinking gasoline, and I'm going, this does not taste sophisticated.
High society are assholes.
No,
there's a definite art to making a good one.
I'm amateur when it comes to martinis. I like extra dirty, extra olives, just vodka and a little splash of olive juice. That's about it.
You wave a little vermouth over the top of the glass?
Well, here's the thing. Now, what are the different ways you can order a martini? Because I've heard dry. I'd like a martini dry.
Right.
I heard straight up. I heard shaken, not stern, of course. But
dry means
extra vermouth, right?
Extra vermouth, yeah. Right?
No, I don't. No. I don't. I martini's dry enough for me. Actually,
I thought dry meant no. No. I don't know.
I don't know either.
I'll tell you in a minute. Let's Google.
We got to get our martini etiquette.
And I'm embarrassed as a bartender for many years, but I don't know.
We're going to revoke your license.
I don't remember. I should say I've made them.
When we're done with this podcast, I have a feeling we're all marching over to Brady's and ordering our favorite.
Yeah.
This guy today is a marching.
Dry martini now.
Here we go. Let's see the different ways to order a martini.
Martini made with gin and vermouth, garnet, blah, blah. Over the years, martini has become one of the best-known mix, blah, blah, blah.
So you can get gin or vodka with or without vermouth.
I like the vodka.
Yeah, that's the only way for me. And
all right.
So I heard the double
doesn't matter.
Way. You don't shake it because you don't want to chip the ice and then have ice chunks in it.
I just thought this guy's in a movie, and it's like a motto. It's like a motto that is iconic, and it's actually, I think, one of the worst ways to make a martini.
You're just like, I just want to be him. I want to be her.
Look, he got a tuxedo on.
Dry martini is made with dry white vermouth, whereas a regular martini
is made with wet.
I don't know what it just says, dry vermouth.
I know there's different kinds of vermouths.
Listeners, send in the answer, right? Send it in.
What I would do when I made a martini was I pour the vermouth into the rocks, and then I dump it out, so it would just stay on the glass.
It's just the whiffed. It's a whiffed.
I wouldn't put the...
Yeah, because there's not enough alcohol in the vermouth for Richie.
No, it's just a hint. Just a hint. Just a hint of vermouth.
So the second thing we know...
All the people we've had on, that was the best one.
Yeah, I think she's hit the home run with the drink.
That's the way I roll.
Yes. We need to have, like, Ed Koch on so we can have a rusty nail or something. Second part is we like to tell jokes, street jokes. Has anyone ever come up to you after a show and said, hey, I got a joke for you?
Well,
or that kind of thing?
Well, they have come up to me and said, are you a comedian? Tell me a joke. And I would say, look down. And that's my favorite.
We almost had a spit take.
Oh, my God, I love physical comedy. But, yeah, that's my favorite. And I prefer that to someone coming up and say, are you a comic? I've got a joke for you, because that just never works out well.
It so rarely works out.
Yeah.
I love when people say, well, you're a comedian, you don't seem funny.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
Or, you know.
You haven't said anything funny yet. Yeah. It's like, well, yeah. Give me $1,000, I'll start being off duty.
Really?
You go up to, like, at a party and, hey, you're a plumber? Come here, I got to show you my sink in the bathroom.
Last week, I ran into a guy I went to high school with, and you were there, Craig, and he's at the bar telling me jokes. And this is a guy I've known since I'm 14 years old. And I go, oh, Craig, shut up. Like, it was so nice to be able... I'm going...
Meanwhile, you were there with your theater friends.
Theater friends, yes.
Do you have theater friends?
Yeah, well, I have a degree in musical theater.
Because I'm a director.
Are you really?
Yes, and I studied at Brooklyn College Performing Arts for directing, and I have some directing projects coming up soon, too.
Well, then we should talk.
We have so much in common. We have a love match here, ladies and gentlemen.
It was the 50th anniversary of the theater department at my college.
Richie, you look really
Joel
good.
Joel and I went.
And, your age, you look great.
I love how he said my college and not our college.
Oh, I forgot that you went there.
No, he
well,
goes,
you weren't a theater major, though. In all fairness,
what was
you're
your
honoring
major?
The
business? So
business.
Back to you guys.
So
you're starting to look
Joe
handsome now.
Joe was a business major.
Sorry, Richie.
And he proves that every time he's on stage. Anyway.
Oh, poor Joe.
He's
well,
back.
The first time I worked for him, we realized we went to the same college. And he was emceeing, and he said, well, how do you want me to bring you up? I said, I want you to introduce me as the best comic from Wagner College, the funniest comic from Wagner College.
I'm also a theater background. Oh, that's why this room is just full of electric.
But I ran, so after the event, we went to a bar, and I ran into a guy I went to high school with. And he starts telling me jokes. And it was so nice to have someone that I could go, shut up. But he wouldn't stop.
And he knew everybody at that
bar.
Yeah,
and he's starting to tell everybody at the bar, this is Richie, he's a comedian. And then he's telling them. And I go, you know what the great thing about you, Craig, is? No one wants to do your job. He's a podiatrist. So it's like, I'm never going to want to do your job. So,
my wife and I, when we first started dating, we went out and there's a big group of people. And she was like, oh, my boyfriend, he's a comedian. And then she just saw the vultures come in.
Yeah,
and then after that, she goes, what should I say when they ask what you do? I go, tell them I'm a garbage man. Anything. Tell them I'm a writer. Those are the only two I'll accept. Because
that'll work.
From now on, if we meet people that we know we're never going to like see again, like if we're on vacation or something, I'm just a writer. And when they ask me what I write, I go, oh, travel column. Because I didn't write for a travel column. Because as soon as they hear comedian, they're going to tell me their best joke, tell me I'm not funny, or ask me to do a little of your shtick. Like,
yes.
No, I'm on vacation. Right. I'm wearing cargo shorts.
It's a funeral.
Yeah.
So now, how did you get into comedy?
Because going from
theater to comedy, it's still entertainment, but it's a bit of a leap.
I was doing my theater thing, and it was not working for me, and I saw Alice Arthur on a cable show doing stand-up, and I said, I can do that. I literally said, I can do
really?
That. And it was kismet.
Yeah.
It just took off, and I'm, excuse me, I'm just delighted that Alice Arthur, myself, and from Night Court, Marsha Warfield, and I are all in a wonderful documentary on black women comics. Jane Galvin Lewis, myself, Marsha Warfield, and Alice Arthur. We go back. This is like from the last century, ladies and gentlemen, yes. And
yes, black women were in comedy in the 20th century.
Yes, yeah. And
it's our podcast, but she's talking, these are my people.
And you're Jewish? I was very fortunate that I was able to have a lot of success with the stand-up comedy. And the funny thing is, I started doing that because I wanted a higher profile as an actress, because
I was a very serious actress.
I studied and worked at the Negro Ensemble Company with them in various positions, mostly missionary. And but
killing.
I never really, you know, got the acting thing, the profile that I wanted, and then the comedy just took off, especially after I got the management of Dave Jonas, who rest in peace. I worked with him, and besides being a Catskills comedy queen, I was also working with fabulous music acts. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I want to talk about this.
Where'd
you get started? Where'd you start doing comedy?
In New York City, I passed first at Catch a Rising Star, and then when I would leave there, I'd come over here and do a set at the Comic Strip.
Right.
But my home clubs were Catch and the Improv downtown when Silver reigned there.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So now you guys are both going from, now were you musical theater or just?
Well, drama, anything. Because that's what I was bringing. I was bringing the drama.
I was more just straight acting. It wasn't really
right.
Any music.
I mean, I did both.
Background.
But
no, of course. But
it's not my fault. I have this amazing voice.
With a voice like that.
don't hate me because I'm talented.
We'll get back to you in a second.
Yeah,
in a
minute. No problem.
We're about to have a lover's quarrel.
Yes, but enough about you. Enough about you. Oh, great. The improv.
I'm just here for the drinks.
But so now you both go through school. You both do the same thing where it was an idea of upping your acting.
Yeah, but for me, people would tell me, I mean, teachers in college were going, any door to open is a good door. You're funny. You should try stand-up. It wasn't like I never, you have.
She had an epiphany.
I can do that.
It was almost an epiphany that you had. You were getting egged on.
I never thought I could.
I literally was just drinking with the comedians at the club and went, yeah, I should do this. Yeah. I thought it would be fun.
That shows.
Yeah, I know. I still drink
with
them.
You're still drinking with the comedians.
All right, let's wrap this up.
I should do this. Yeah. I still haven't gotten on stage. But drinking with comics
is fun.
It's
in your future, Mark. It really is.
How did you get involved in directing?
Well, I was at Brooklyn College and went to graduate school for directing. And when I found how heavy the course load was for graduate school, I said, fuck this.
Really?
Oh my God, it was I spent all my time in the library doing research and writing papers, and all the people that I knew were actually in films, and they were on stage.
Acting.
They were acting. They were doing stuff. And you know, I was sitting
doing
in the library
having
a nervous breakdown. Yeah. But then I started working with writers' workshops and got to know a lot of playwrights who would ask me to direct readings of their work or direct productions, and I'm very proud, most proud of a production that I did with the New Federal Theater that actually won Best Ensemble Adelco. That's for Excellence in Black Theater. Real Black Men Don't Sit Cross-Legged on the Floor. And it was really, it was funny, it was shocking, it was sad, it was topical at the time.
Well, that's true, because they have that huge thing in
that's
the middle
right.
that they
exactly.
can't cross.
You got to the crux of the matter.
Right.
And I continue to do that. I actually have a piece that's been commissioned by Dixon Place, which is a wonderful art institute downtown. It's going to be coming up in October, and then just in a couple of weeks in June, I'm directing a reading of a piece at the Wow Cafe.
Wow, that's great.
That's
yeah,
amazing.
Wow.
This is
wow,
cool.
Yeah, I can't believe you just did that. The Wow
He's
Cafe.
Plugging. So what was your moment when you started doing stand-up that you felt was your, I know it's a million tiny steps to move up, but what was like a moment that hit you that was like, oh my God, I'm a real comedian?
Well, I loved being on the stage of Radio City Music Hall and having
How
thousands and thousands of people laughing at me.
I did that too.
It's so weird how I think you two are about to get married.
I think I'm the male Rhonda Hanson.
Well,
a little salt, little pepper.
Let's just say the white one, not
who
the,
did you open first?
The female. Look at his haircut.
I love this guy.
I didn't want to say that because you're funny. That was funny. Who did
we
you
have that
for?
On tape. He said you're funny.
Huh? Yeah, we're going to just, can you cut that and we'll just keep playing it over
put
and
that
over?
In a loop.
Well,
yes.
I'm drunk. So. Joel's funny to me right now.
Ah, that's
so
vermouth.
What got you to Radio City Music Hall?
Anita Baker. I did 2.5 years with her, touring with her. We did indoor venues across the country that were like Radio City Music Hall, like the Fox, and just across the country, and then all the outdoor venues across the country, and it was just fantastic.
So you were used to playing big venues, because that 7,000 people.
I got used to it real quick. Well, when I heard them laughing, I said, "This is where I belong." It's completely different.
Oh,
even,
my God.
Even working at Westbury Music Fair is different because that's in the round.
In the round.
And you have to really, you know, be aware of that and
it
deal
is a
with,
little
the, with the physicality
like,
of it.
Where'd the guy go?
For all the listeners out there, tell people what it's like to perform not only in front of that many people, but indoor versus outdoor, and also being the comedy act opening for a music act. What's that like?
Sometimes it could be a little scary. Most of the time, I loved it because you're doing doing 15 or 20 at tops.
Okay, okay.
And the show's not on you. You just have to keep people...
You're filling time.
You're filling time.
Almost like a pep rally, like just keeping them the energy high.
You're filling time until everybody gets in their seats. The one time, the only one time that I had a problem on tour with Anita Baker was when we went to Greenville, North Carolina, and her chauffeur took her to Greenville, South Carolina.
Oh, boy.
And we were in a hot gymnasium where people were standing, and the show was 45 minutes late. And once they knew she was on her way to the real venue, they threw me out on stage, and people started shouting, "You're not Anita! You're not Anita! You're not Anita!" And I did my time, but I swear to God, when I came off that stage, I could not see, speak, or walk. The guy, you know, one of the roadies had to help me down off the stage.
Wow.
And I just sat still for a moment, and then I found a nice martini.
Ah! And it came full. Wow. Well, I thought they might have thrown you out when you were supposed to go out, and then you found out she was in another state.
No, well, they knew
and
that.
And you had to stretch.
They knew that she had to get from another place.
Did they fire the driver?
I hope so.
Paul Provenza had a great joke about opening for a music act. He goes, "It's like when you go to the deli and you order a sandwich and they put that little pickle in the meal. I'm the pickle. You didn't expect me. You didn't expect me, but I'm here.
Right. You're not paying for me."
I had a wonderful experience with Tony Orlando. Not many people can say that.
Oh, my God. Now we're talking.
I don't know why I chose to buy a new car on the same day that I was opening for him out at Westbury Music Fair. And I had,
what a day.
Yeah, and I had no idea how long it took to do all the paperwork. You know, they keep sending you from one office to another.
It's brutal.
And it was a weekend, and the traffic out to Long Island was like crazy. And I ended up being incredibly late. I mean, absolutely late. People,
Tony opened for you.
The man actually did that. They didn't want to let me in when I got to the door, and my son was little at the time, and he was with me, and he started crying, "You better let my mommy do her show. You better let my mommy do her show." And finally, they let me in, and Tony says, "Let me introduce you." And he went out and gave me a fabulous intro. Ladies and gentlemen, this young lady was caught in traffic. She's a wonderful comedian. Put your hands together for the comedy of Rhonda Hanson.
I'll do it right now.
Yeah. And I have to love him forever for that, because they did not have to put me on. But
they were holding the curtain for you. So he had not gone out to perform.
No, he hadn't gone out because, it was going to open with me. I was here early. I mean, knocking on the door, go, "Let me in." I show up every place early. I am never on colored people's time.
Which is ironic.
And ironically, I'm always late. We're like yin and yang.
Wait,
shut up.
So how late were you, or what's the time?
Well, I was... I was there at the time knocking on the door when the show should have been starting.
When you should have been on stage, or when Tony should have been on stage?
When I got to the backstage door after being in crazy Long Island traffic, that's, I'm knocking on the door when the show should have started. And then everyone had a right to be, livid.
Yeah. Did you knock three times?
Thank you. Richard Burns.
Several times. And I was just happy that it ended that well. And I will always love Tony for that.
That's a really special memory.
The only comedian I ever seen at Westbury was David Lee Roth.
Really?
They were playing Panama. And you know the part of the song where he's like, "I reach back between my legs." He started doing crowd work. "Hey, where are you from? You look like a Jericho."
Yeah, he does that on with Van Halen now too. I heard him. That's so funny. I heard a concert, and at that point he turned to Eddie's son,
Wolfgang.
And he just turned and goes, "Wolfie, this is your first time in Japan, right?" And I'm like, "What the hell's he doing? Like, he's just, how you liking Japan? It's cool, right?"
Dude, you see Michael Anthony in the back giving the stretch sign.
So you worked with Anita Baker, Tony Orlando.
Who else?
The Pointer Sisters.
Really?
Smokey Robinson.
Oh, really?
Melissa Manchester.
So weird. I'm opening for her in February.
Great. Tell her I said hello.
I will.
I loved opening for Jackie Mason and... I mean, it was just a cavalcade of people.
I met Jackie Mason here at the Strip years ago, and he came up to me, and he goes, do you know what time I go on? I go, I don't work here. He goes, then why am I talking to you?
Yeah.
He just walked away.
I opened up for him at Staten Island. He was just trying to do, getting ready for his new one-man show, and Vic, the owner, goes, do 12 minutes. I thought Jackie, he didn't even know me. He goes, how about 7.5?
He loved you that much.
7.5.
Wow.
I like Jackie Mason, but it would have been really funny if he goes, what time am I going on here? And you went, 30 years ago.
He's a legend, though.
He is. Yeah,
he's a legend.
Was that one? Because I'm very intrigued by you know, how you've opened off for all these musicians.
Oh, Aretha Franklin.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
Now, but did you open up for one and it just kind of opened the floodgate that you kind of got into
that? I had people at the time, Joel. I had
not
people.
Not like people like Mark and I had.
Yes.
Had real people.
I had real people, and they were getting me these wonderful gigs. And
I had
it was,
people at the time. Like, that's my favorite part of the whole story. At the time. Not now.
But would they have, like, because... I imagine they would want to see your act. So, like, did they come and see you at a club and all of a sudden they're
well,
like, yep,
see, the thing
the
that
lady.
I found out is that if something is supposed to be, it will be. So the agent and my manager worked together. And I remember I was out of my mind trying to get people to come over to the improv to see me audition for the agents. And it was a rainy night. So few people showed up. I went up and I did well, but it was a light crowd, which is not usual back in the day at the improv. It was a light crowd. And I felt like, fuck, all these people are always asking me, let me know when you're doing something. And I said, come out. This is going to change my life. You know, and
I
and,
can't on Tuesday.
Exactly.
People always do it. I'm coming. I'm going to be there.
And I was really pissed off at everyone that they didn't show up. And, it happened anyway, you
That's
know?
Awesome.
It happened anyway, and I had the most fun of my life playing to these huge crowds, Vegas, Tahoe, you know, all of these, you know, huge music venues. I was actually at the Grand Ole Opry. I mean
wow.
I've been
wow.
In such wonderful venues and being with such talented people. I feel blessed, actually.
That's so amazing.
And well, here I am with you guys. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to say your career.
You know what? No, I don't want to say you don't have people now.
I don't. I have no people.
Well, it shows.
Except you three wonderful men. I have you. I have
now,
you in the palm of my hand.
Perfect segue.
I used to work at NBC, and Aretha Franklin was on The Tonight Show. And she insisted on there was no air conditioning in the whole building.
The Queen of Soul.
Was she like that when you worked with her?
The Queen of Soul. We were in like Atlantic City and Vegas when we did our things. I remember we were in Vegas and she's walking. I think I was coming off stage and she was walking on and she had one shoe on and one shoe off. And I said to her, do you want me to help you get your shoe on? And she goes, no. And she just kept walking with one shoe on and one shoe off.
She was in the hallway.
But she's the Queen of Soul, and I bow down.
It was like one of those people where I'm like, I really, really want to go over to her, but I didn't.
Well, you know, I when I opened for James Brown, I could not even walk past his dressing room. I had to go underneath the stage.
Really?
And go and then go on to open for him. And the thing about it is, these people, these major stars, they have the lives of so many people on their shoulders. And when they're asking just for, you know, the green M&Ms, or when they want, you know, you to not, they don't want anyone to have eye contact with them. Anita Baker actually had her bodyguard on the sound equipment because she didn't want anybody touching the settings that she wanted.
Really?
And yeah. And you know, I think... Whenever somebody has these unusual requests, I say,
There's a reason.
There's a reason for it, because their name is on the marquee. Actually, when we were at Radio City Music Hall, my name was on the marquee too, along with hers. But
mine wasn't.
I loved it. I really loved it. Walking down Sixth Avenue, Avenue of the Americas. I couldn't believe it.
But that's huge.
But when they have these quirks, you know, they obviously are dependent upon those, or they need these things to make sure that they deliver. And, you know, they're paying everyone's salary.
I completely am on the same wavelength with you on that, because there's, people complain, these celebrities, and they have their stupid riders, and they're out. There's a reason. And it's the same as when you go to a comedy club on the road, and they're like, you're only allowed to do this. And you're like, okay, there's a story behind this. Who fucked this up?
Yeah.
Somebody fucked with her vocals on her settings and probably ruined a show.
Well, you know, people want it the way they want it, to give you the best that they can. Yeah.
I think that you make a great point that there's a lot of pressure on being a celebrity, just being a performer and a celebrity. That
one fuck up, and
like
everywhere.
She said, there's so many jobs on the line.
Yeah.
If you don't work, all these people probably aren't working either.
Yeah.
So, that is a lot of pressure, you know, and I don't think people realize that.
Wrap their head around it.
I ran into him and he wouldn't talk to me.
She had an entire band. Then she had backup singers.
Yeah.
And a road crew. So many people.
Well, and the people that sell tickets, the people who sell the
merchandise,
soda, the thing, all that stuff. Those are all people making their living because this person is coming to town.
Yeah. So
there's a lot of pressure.
I love musical acts, and they can be as quirky as they like, as long as I'm opening for them.
As long as the check clears.
Yeah.
Rich, did you tell on the show what you were doing at Radio City? Have you told it yet?
No.
What were you doing at Radio City telling jokes?
I opened for, what do you mean? Who did I open for?
Yeah.
Well, I opened for Dr. Oz, which I don't know why you're bringing that up, though.
No,
I think you're messing with me.
It was to compare stories.
Oh, okay.
You said I do the warm-up
for the Dr. Oz show.
Oh, cool.
And he did a show at Radio City, and he asked me to open for him. But it was, the funny thing is there was a company, USANA, who I do a lot of work for now. They were, you know, pretty much backing it. And when I went out, the first 3,000 seats were all people who worked for USANA. And I went out and I said, how about a big hand for Ixana? And I got booed. I mean, no one gets booed at Radio City. I got booed. They were booing me. I couldn't remember the name of the – I choked so bad. I'm like –
I thought you did it on purpose.
No, I completely forgot the name.
Well, then that makes sense.
And one guy literally got up and went, you suck. And I'm like, this is so awesome. I'm getting booed. And meanwhile, the other 4,000 people, they didn't care. They didn't care then, but the 3,000 USANA people were very pissed.
In my entire career, I don't think I've had 3,000 people boo me. You had it all at once.
Yes, I did.
That's a record.
Let's get this out of the way now.
I can't remember how I got out of it. I started singing. I go, what's the name? And they were yelling, USANA. And I said, what's the name? The name? And they go, USANA. USANA. I go, well, now we know it. And when I came off the head of USANA, I goes, you didn't do that on purpose? He thought I did it.
As like an advertisement?
Yeah.
As a bit.
I'm like, yeah.
He thought he was doing a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And you turned it into an advertisement and a pep rally.
Yes.
When I say you,
USANA.
You.
Yeah. You suck? No, USANA.
USANA. That feeling of 7,000 people is amazing.
It's great. It's absolutely unbelievable.
What's the biggest crowd you ever played to, do you know?
Well, Radio City Music Hall was the best because you have the balcony and then all of those seats.
Did you go out when it was empty?
Well, of course. I always go to the venue. I'm always early.
Yeah, but
I go to the venue and, you know, walk the space and do a sound check, get a feeling for it. I love that stuff.
You just see the tears. It's so cool.
Not on any level close to this of you guys, but to me, I always have these moments where I just go, I can't believe I'm seeing this or doing this just because I tell jokes. Because we might not be financially the
most set people on the planet.
We're not.
But we live like rich people wish they could. Because we see so much cool stuff.
Yeah.
How much would it cost to have somebody pay money to get on Radio City Music Hall's stage in a packed house? How much money would that cost?
You know,
you
people
got paid to do it.
People would give their eye teeth to have Diana Ross say, "Don't look at me."
You have to have how many times, like how many great moments?
I love that. I love the way she snuck that in.
Yeah. Oh, she snuck a lot in. Monday's Tall, Dark, and Handsome. Yeah, Sirius XM. I mean, every time we ask a question, I'm like, boom.
It's what I do.
I know.
Years ago, I opened for Air Supply. Remember Air Supply?
We'll be right back to you. Richie's got to brag for a moment.
No problem.
No, I'm not bragging. So after the show, they were meeting their fans. They had like one of these meet and greets. So I went up, and I go, "Hey, man!" And they, "Oh, you were funny." I go, "Hey, I'm a big." I go, "I love you. I always loved you guys." And they go, "No, you didn't." Like they knew. And I'm like, "Yeah, nah, yeah." And we ended up getting drunk that night. It was great. I'm like, "I'm drinking with Air Supply."
I wanted to ask you though, because like you're filling time when you're in front of those 7,000 people. Is it like a pin drop, or do you feel as though like half the people are listening? Or
it depends. It on really which the musical it really acts depends, it was especially like if you're outside.
The venue.
You know, a Boston Commons was the first venue that I did with Anita Baker, and that was outdoor. And lightning struck that night. Someone was sitting in a tree and fell down. You know, you never know what's going to happen. It can be people, you know, trying to find their seats, milling about, and then, you know, there's whenever there's a core of people listening to you, you play to them and they draw other people in. And that's what I love when you realize that as you're going along, you know, more people are responding.
And that is a big mistake of young comedians. And I had it too. And I had a comedian tell me to stop doing it. You try to play to the people that aren't listening, and then play to the people that are.
Yeah.
Even if it's one person.
It'll work.
My case all the time.
Well, that's the other thing. You're not looking at them as 1,000 people. You're looking at them as the one or two people who are actually into you, you know, and you give them your best. That's all you can do. You know, it's just like what you guys do here on the podcast. You're not talking to millions and millions of people. You know, you're
said we are.
Oh.
All right, let's wrap.
And we're definitely not trying our best.
My bad. You're talking to millions and millions of people.
You're talking.
But you give the effect of a personal interaction.
Yes.
And that's what really connects you with people. You know, even when we're doing something here in the club. I remember one of the best things when Catch a Rising Star and the Improv and also here at the Comic Strip, when you come back from a gig either in Jersey or Pennsylvania and it's late night and you're talking to somebody. That's when the clubs were open until 1 o'clock, two o'clock in the morning. And maybe it's like two tables, four tables, and you're having a great time.
I agree with
you. It's that personal connection that feels so good, especially if you know you get a laugh on a new line and you go, "Okay, I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm good."
Yeah.
That's really cool.
I love city clubs on a Tuesday when there's seven people.
Yeah.
Seriously, you can have such a good time with those
it's
people.
It's one of those things when you're even on the road and you show up and there's like only a few people there and then the club owners or the managers like apologize. And I always go, no, I should apologize to you. You guys aren't going to make money tonight.
Yeah.
But I'm going to have a great time.
Yeah.
Because I get to know these seven people.
Well, I love when you do that, and there's always a reason. First of all, they always go, "I should have been here last week." I love when they do that. Last week.
And the other thing is,
you know what happened? There's a strawberry
festival
town. I mean, you go,
everybody
really,
goes to strawberry
I couldn't compete
festival.
With the strawberry festival.
At 10 at night?
But you're right that we get to do this kind of thing because we're just telling jokes. We're just talking to people, and it's a fun job. It's a fun job.
I love this business. I really do. As much as I get mad and I'll get frustrated over little things, I absolutely love the fact you get to perform in front of all these amazing people. And how cool is it that you're not just there at work, you're there watching what you would pay to go and do.
I would stand in the wings every night with the Pointer Sisters because they were just so incredible, and dance with Anita Baker, just, you know, listening, just sitting there listening to
you. You would have paid money to go to the concert.
Absolutely.
Now you're being paid to be there in front of them.
Absolutely.
Like, it's amazing. Now, on a very opposite than you guys, I've opened for heavy metal bands. Different world.
Wow.
That's called survival. You go out and just basically fill time, and they're yelling at you, and you're yelling at them. And it's,
yeah, but tell her what you did that one time. It's such a great
story.
What
did you do?
I was so nervous. And this is actually how I kind of got into wanting to do stand-up, was I went out and pretended I was tuning a guitar, and I was like, check, check, one, check, check. Like, I was checking the mics, and all of a sudden, I would go to the next thing, and then I'd go over and, hey, where are you from? You guys, how many people are from whatever town or other?
Oh, that's great.
People are like, the band sucked, but the roadie was good.
That roadie was hysterical.
Oh, how wonderful.
When the band was ready to come out, like, I would kind of get in the material and kind of do whatever, because I would start, like, cheering, doing cheerleading kind of stuff. And then I would start talking about myself. And then when the band was ready to come on, I go, oh, shit, I got to get off stage. Ladies and gentlemen, Dizzy Hoare!
Oh.
And then I'd get on stage. And the band would be cracking up because they know me. My brother's the singer. And they're cracking up because I acted like I was a roadie. Meanwhile, I don't know how to play fucking guitar.
But the audience loved you.
But then if you suck, they're like, why'd that roadie do that? But if you're a great, you're the greatest roadie ever.
So, I think we're good.
Well,
I think
this is great.
We're 40 minutes in here.
Yeah, that was Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling. You guys got an extra 10 minutes.
Ron,
out of
thank you so
what?
Much.
Yeah, thank you. My gosh,
we will definitely have
I'm
you
in
back.
A small, cramped room with three white guys. What more could I want?
We make dreams come true.
Yes,
like Friar said, I died and went to the wrong heaven.
Last call. Thanks for listening to Drinks, Jokes, and Storytelling.